Ladies and gentlemen, it's Friday, February the 6th, and time for our morning roundup of the latest developments at home and overseas. Our reporter overseas and in the nation's capitals are standing by, and we turn first to the capital of Soviet Russia for a report by Robert Magadov. We'll take you now first direct. Just a moment, I'm waiting. I'm monitoring Moscow now. I'm not sure whether we're going to get that signal from the Russian capital or not. No, at the present moment, Moscow is not ready. We have some news dispatches here in our newsroom in New York, and we'll continue on with that while we monitor Moscow. In the Far East Indies from Batavia comes word that the Netherlands Indies High Command announced today the Japanese forces have occupied Samarinda. Now, no further details are given about the action in the town, which is 60 miles north of the oil port of Balikpapan on the east coast of Borneo. Samarinda was a feeding point for the Balikpapan oil installations, and it also is an important coal district at the mouth of the Kutai River. Many civilians already had been evacuated from Samarinda, which ordinarily has a population of about 12,000 persons, including 300 Europeans. Military circles at Batavia, meanwhile, believe that the heavy escort of 20 fighters accompanying the air raid on Surabaya yesterday indicate that a Japanese plane carrier is in the vicinity. Now, the Japanese don't have any land base within striking distance of the United Nations key base in the Southwest Pacific, thus accounting for the assumption. Nipponese fighter planes attacked a number of towns in East Java today, but no damage is mentioned. Enemy planes also have been sighted over southeast Borneo and near Medan on the east coast of Sumatra. From Singapore, we hear that 14 civilians were killed and 104 were injured in yesterday's air raids. Now, this brings the toll for the past 3 days to 77 killed and 332 injured. Our shortwave listening post has picked up reports from the Russian front this morning, indicating that a steady advance on all sectors is going on in spite of bringing up of German reinforcements. Now, on the central front, the Russians are continuing to force their way from the north and the south towards Vyazma and the Vyazma-Smolensk Railway. Russians have recaptured 5 more strongly defended villages in a battle which cost the Germans 5,200 killed. Russian cavalry, operating in the Kalinin sector, destroyed a number of German aircraft, 150 trucks with war supplies, and wiped out 800 officers and men. From Balboa and the Canal Zone, the Army's brand new strategic highway across the Isthmus of Panama has passed its demonstration tests. Army machines now can travel from ocean to ocean over the 48-mile route in 2 hours, and thus a third and well-separated route has been added to the canal and railway, which, up to now, had been the only avenues of heavy transport across the Isthmus of Panama. The highway was begun in December of 1940, but Army engineers took it over after Pearl Harbor, and after 14 days of terrific labor, they drove a trail across the last 7 miles of jungle-covered hills and deep ravines. At some places, the highway is still only a one-way graded trail through the dense foliage. But the Public Roads Administration now is going to lay a two-way, 50-mile-an-hour concrete highway over that route. The job must be done before the arrival of the tropical rainy season, which would speedily reduce the present trail into impenetrable jungle again. Now, engineers figure that they can get the highway paved in 2 months if they're granted a full quota of dry weather. From the Mediterranean, word comes from Rome that the Italians say the Axis forces in Libya have advanced to within 60 miles of Tobruk. Now, the fascist communique claims that Axis troops are pushing the British steadily backwards and have occupied the town of Tamimi. That's on the Mediterranean coast, about 140 miles from the Egyptian border. From Mexico City, a group of American businessmen has severed its connections with the wealthy Swedish industrialist Alex Wennergren. Now, they were associated with him in a $100 million investment project, but have withdrawn because Wennergren has been blacklisted by the United States State Department, and he's accused of trading to the benefit of Axis powers. One leader of the group says that American financiers already have been approached to replace the capital Wennergren would have invested. Now, the project includes highway, railroad, and industrial construction in strategic regions of Mexico. Meanwhile, friends of the Swedish financier say that they still regard the blacklisting as an injustice. Efforts are underway in Washington to have him reinstated. The industrialist is widely known as a friend of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor and of prominent German dignitaries, including Field Marshal Goering. He's rented a luxurious home on the most fashionable avenue in Mexico City and plans to remain there. Now, there's no indication as to what attitude Mexico will adopt toward his business activities. Winogrand also has been blacklisted in the Bahamas, where he previously resided. And here's a communique from Berlin and Germany. German airmen are credited with damaging 3 merchant ships in waters near England last night. The Nazi High Command says that bombers also made a smashing attack against railway targets on the Newcastle-Edinburgh line. And now for a report on developments. We switch you to London.
This is London. John McVane speaking. Authoritative quarters in London still don't confirm the Japanese report that the big offensive against Singapore Island has begun. Official news reaching here only says that the British have been shelling Japanese communications on the mainland, and the Japanese have done some shelling across the straits against the northern part of the island. Japanese planes are making low-level machine gun and bombing attacks against British troops. From 2.5 years of war, most Britishers have become amateur military strategists. In the clubs and the pubs and the homes, you'll hear a lot of argument about every move that the allies of the Axis make. When things go bad in any theater of war, a lot of people now are trying to get what satisfaction they can from the assumption that in the long run and in the grand strategy, things will work out all right. In the Greece and Crete campaigns, for instance, there was a certain amount of bitter criticism. Months later, the British realized that those lost battles had held up the German drive into Russia and forced the Germans to campaign in winter when they weren't prepared for it. So today, you find a greater readiness among the British to assume the long-range view of this world war. Nobody in this island likes the battering that the Allies are getting in the Far East. They don't like Rommel's successes in Libya. But they feel that once the German army is beaten in Europe, dealing with Japan will not be a difficult proposition. The Aeroplane, the authoritative British aircraft magazine, today explains why American troops were sent to Britain. The explanation is a simple one. Only with Russian help can the Allies carry out a successful attack on Japan itself. Once Japan is conquered, their tentacles in Malaya, the Philippines, and the Pacific Islands can be lopped off without much trouble. But Russia can't help in the battle against Japan until the German threat is removed. So Germany becomes the first enemy to lick. Allied offensive preparations are much farther advanced in the West than in the East. And the Aeroplane explains that the sending of American troops to Britain isn't a dispersion of Allied strength, but a form of time economy designed to speed up offensive plans in the theater of war where we are best prepared. The American troops in Britain will release British troops for immediate offensive operations and may themselves share in a big Western offensive. The Aeroplane says that as France was once the springboard for British troops, so Britain is now the forward base for the Americans. And the paper declares that anything the Allies can do to free Russia from her engagements in the West would improve the prospects of a Russian decision to settle with Japan while she spread out like a gigantic octopus over half the Pacific and a slice of Asia. From the technical point of view, the campaign in Libya seems to have proved one thing clearly to most aircraft experts. The Allies need planes that can destroy tanks. It's being said that the planes must carry bigger guns for anti-tank work. The little 20-millimeter cannon that are standard British equipment are too small to knock out heavy tanks. And it's even being said that now something bigger than the 37-millimeter cannon is needed to break up enemy armored columns from the air. One British expert today says, "What we want is the land equivalent of the air-launched torpedo to knock out the land battleships as effectively as the sea battleships can be disposed of from the air." And he adds, "The Russians appear to have found one secret of success in the form of a rocket-fired bomb." The fact that King Farouk of Egypt chose Nahas Pasha, head of the Waft Nationalist Party, as his new prime minister is being well received in London. The British are saying that Nahas is loyal to the principle of friendship and cooperation with Britain and that he's the only man who can offer the prospect of political stability. Incidentally, observers here who know young King Farouk have a great deal of respect for him. He's said to be a brilliant manipulator of men and governments. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Now, a report of developments in our own nation by Earl Godwin from the newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. Washington didn't score very heavily on the dramatic side yesterday in the news, and I suppose that's the reason why so much space is given to the hullabaloo hereabouts over comparatively trivial matters, such as the two friends of Mrs. Roosevelt, who have been given good, hard jobs in the Office of Civilian Defense, and the loud outcry over the fact that members of Congress have included themselves at last in the nationwide Social Security system. And by contributing a small slice of their wages, they will build up a fund which, along with government contributions, provides an annuity at age 65, I think it is. Well, it's the same thing that everyone with a Social Security card enjoys, and it will be more widespread rather than less as time goes on. And yet this particular thing, because it's members of Congress, attracts the adverse attention of a great many people, including two active senators, Capper of Kansas and Byrd of Virginia. The latter is well known for his economy crusade. A member of the House, who has spent 25 years in Congress at a fraction of the pay that he could have won for himself in practicing law, for instance, said to me yesterday, "Remember, Capper and Byrd are very rich men themselves." Actually, there is one reason to welcome and support the idea of retirement pay, small retirement pay, for members of Congress. It is merely a part of the general scheme, this retirement pay, and from a moral standpoint, it would seem to be better than making government jobs, creating government jobs, at very high pay for so-called lame duck congressmen. There are several, I should say many, who are on the government payroll for years after having been retired by their constituents. Many of them do good jobs, particularly federal judges appointed by the president from the ranks of lawmakers. But in the old days, a congressman was defeated, and then he came back for that short session. And in that short session, his colleagues and he would legislate a new job or a new commission into being, and the defeated member got a swell job. And this day, my friends, is the 9th anniversary of the day on which that lame duck session of Congress was wiped out by the Norris Amendment. That is, this was the day on which it was proclaimed. It seems to me the two Mrs. Roosevelt appointments have not had a good press or a good radio. One reason is they've been attacked but never explained. And Representative Leland Ford of California keeps up the attack. He wants a congressional committee to look into the matter, thinks the Appropriations Committee should look into it. Ford says they are making a Roman holiday out of defense. The movie actor, Melvin Douglas, who was given a civil defense job, says he intends to organize and line up movie actors, movie writers, and all that goes along with Hollywood for their part in civil defense. And Maris Chaney, nightclub dancer, inventor of the Eleanor Glide, is working in Philadelphia alongside of old-time athlete John B. Kelly in the health and outdoor activities side of civil defense. Many members of Congress think we need more bomb shelters and less rhythmic dancers, but of course, they may be old-fashioned. Anyhow, it'll come out in full debate when the civil defense bill comes up. It'll be before the House officially, probably at noon today, and you will learn, as the debates go along, that on defenses against bombs and artillery, we are in a very bad way, and Congress will be asked to rush that $100 million for defense. Incidentally, let me give you an advance reminder to turn your clock ahead an hour before going to bed Sunday night, because the whole country goes on wartime, or victory time, wartime, the president calls it, beginning at 2 o'clock Monday morning. The only exception is the Weather Bureau, which is going to stick to standard time, and that's all from Washington at this time.
Well, that's the news up to this moment, ladies and gentlemen. These have been reports by Earl Godwin in Washington, John McVane in London, and John Fraser, your reporter, speaking from New York. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.